Okay, very good. Can you hear okay? Okay. Sense desire is my biggest problem. My spouse claims that I am always needy and clingy. I will sense the next one. Please help me as I would like to get to jhana if possible. Okay, it's sense desire. Look, whoever wrote this, you've got a spouse, so you know you've got one, so you've got to look after them. So you know you're committed. So you have to have some sense desire to just look after your partner, unless actually you talk together and you sort of decide to have a more platonic relationship. Sometimes people do that when they get older in life. The sexual urge doesn't get so strong, and they decide that, you know, they're very good friends. They have a spiritual relationship, you know, without any sexuality there. And sometimes if you grow together, that's very lucky that you can do such things. But spouse claims are always needy and clingy. Sometimes you've got no choice there because, you know, you've got into that relationship, that's your karma, you've got to work through it. But still, when you come on retreat, you know, even if your spouse does actually come on the retreat with you, on the retreat they're not your spouse. You know, they're just, we're fellow meditators. It's just when I come on a retreat, I'm not the abbot, I don't bring Bodhinyana Monastery with me. So that you leave all of that past duties, responsibilities aside. And when you come here, you're just the person. When you go back again, then you have your husband, you have your wife again. But when you're here, you're just an ordinary person. So at least on these retreats, you'll probably be able to get into the deep meditations. But as long as you let go of the past. If you don't let go of the past, then you bring your spouse with you, and don't mean physically, but in your mind, and all the problems which have you have, living together with another person, then of course you'll never get into jhanas or any deep meditation. So in other words, leave your spouse out of your mind. So just go into the present moment and put a big notice up. Husband cannot come in. Wife not allowed in the present moment. And then, what's the difference between being like a monk and being just a meditator? The point is that once you let go of your body, once you let go of your past and future, then what's the difference? Nothing. So, that means you can do whatever you want. As long as you don't carry those burdens from the past into the present moment. That makes sense? Okay, the next question. If chanting has no significance in terms of altering events, why are there chants such as protection from fire? And didn't the monks at Bodhinyana chant this chant when the big bushfire swept through the monastery? Did it work? If it worked, it wouldn't have swept through the monastery, would it? So, yeah, we do some of those chanting sometimes. Most of the time it doesn't work, but we still do it anyway. It's something to do. So, well, we can't do anything else, I suppose. There you go, you sit there and worry or whatever, you might as well chant. The point is, a lot of times we do all these chanting, all these rigmarole and stuff like that in Buddhism, and it only has minimal effect, but it does have an effect on just giving you confidence, you know, giving you sort of a little bit of encouragement, and that's always very, very nice, actually, just the psychological effects of chanting. Because at least you know if, like, the monks are chanting for you when you're in hospital or you're sick, you think, oh, at least they care. And that makes you feel good. So there's something happens there. But it's also that actually that chanting does have an effect. But it's a minimal effect. What you do has much more effect than what the monks do for chanting. And it certainly doesn't have much of an effect upon your grades when you do the examinations. Nor does the chanting have any effect on who wins a cricket match. Nor does the chanting... Because that's what happened. That, you know, there was... For those of you who live here in Western Australia, or live in Victoria, there was some very important... AFL matches on just before the rain. Well, I think during the rain retreat. And I think it was... Was it a semi-final or something? It looked like the Dockers were going to play the Eagles. And if that had happened, I'd have been in big trouble, because half my disciples say, please chant for the eagles. And the other one was thought, no, no, please chant for the Dockers. I don't know what I would have done. Maybe we'd have to do 50 minutes chanting for the eagles and then another 50 minutes chanting for the Dockers afterwards. And if one of the teams had won, you see, the chanting worked. But a lot of the chanting, a lot of that rigmarole, is it's okay, it does help a little bit, because it gives people a little bit of faith, and it does have a little bit of power, I must admit. There is a psychic portion to some of the chanting, if it's done properly. But it's nowhere near as effective as actually, you know, doing things like keeping the precepts, or meditating, or becoming wise. So the trouble is that when we just focus on chanting, Buddhism becomes like a chanting religion. And we just chant, 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 chant. And no one actually understands what the meaning of those chants are. And we become like a superficial religion of just ritual, rather than actually understanding what those chants are talking about. Is, now, keep your precepts, keep virtues, because that makes you happy. It makes them a much safer world. It brings you more prosperity, brings you more inner strength. Meditate, because there you get peaceful, you get wise, you get healthy. And use your wisdom, because that leads to harmony, peace, and progress in the world. So that's what Buddhism is all about. It's not just like a chanting, but sometimes that's what happens. I must admit that one of the first times I went to Singapore, I was very, very discouraged, because I went into a Burmese temple. And as I was going into the Burmese temple, at the entrance there was a monk doing the chanting and sprinkling holy water and collecting all the money. And I thought, oh, sound right. I mean, there was a monk, you know, doing all this rigmarole, but when I went upstairs, there was a lay person teaching meditation. And I think you can see what I meant there. So the monks were sort of in the high income part of the temple, but the lay person was doing what a monk should have been doing, teaching meditation. So because of that, sometimes you're a little bit down on chanting, but I do a lot of chanting myself, and it's okay, and it does work sometimes. But it's not as important as some of the other things which we do.
You know, a few years ago when we celebrated the 20th
Yes, yeah.
But it was like, was rainy and so on, but you managed to sort of... Like,
yeah, but that was actually with another power. That was with Aditana. Aditana is when you make some very, very strong resolutions. So you do use the power of the mind, but not through chanting. You sit down and make a resolution. Yeah, that was amazing, that one. For those of you who don't know that, if you want to know psychic phenomena and supernatural events, that was our 30th anniversary of the Buddhist Society in West Australia. And being born under the sign of Leo, when we do something, we want to do something big. So when somebody suggests we should celebrate, they say, yeah, let's celebrate it big time. First of all, they wanted to do it on the South Perth Esplanade. They said, no, that's too far away. Let's do it in the Supreme Court Gardens, right in the centre of the city. Let's for once have in-your-face Buddhism in Australia. In other words, let's be proud of, you know, what we've achieved, and let's actually show off. So that was a big amount of organisation. And when I do these things, as most of you know, if I say let's do it, then I take responsibility and I get, you know, right stuck in there organising things. So I, you know, really sort of worked incredibly hard. And so we worked incredibly hard. We got everything organized. We had the Premier, Jeff Gallop, coming, all these other dignitaries coming. The Thai ambassador showed up as well. And the morning of the event, when I woke up in the morning, it was raining. It was an outdoor event. It was actually the full moon night. It was Vaisak. And it was raining. And you looked to the newspaper, and it was rain was going to get worse. Not just showers, thunder, storm, a big weather front was coming in. And during the morning it got worse and worse. And I remember one of the monks who said, you're crazy, Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't do this, cancel it. And because we had the Premier of Western Australia coming, three times the Premier's office rang up. They said, should we cancel? Three times I said, no way. I didn't actually say no way, I said no. But whenever you tell a story, you know, you've got to sort of give it a bit of colour. So we're going to go ahead with this. and it was raining and pouring down. I remember this monk, he was just so upset at me. He said, "You're crazy, stop it, just don't be so proud." But we did those aditanas, some very, very strong aditanas. So day was, look, this is our 30th anniversary. This is Waisak night. We've got all these people coming. This is the Dhamma. You better do something. And I always remember that moment. We had a few tents, and I was in one of the tents, just organizing things. And I remember this very close disciple just came in crying. "What's up?" He said, come outside quickly. I said, I'd already noticed the rain had stopped. The reason why she was crying, that the clouds had parted. And this beautiful full moon, just over the center of Perth. And it stayed like that. There was a very quick shower for about 1 minute, just halfway during the ceremony, but then it was dry again. And as soon as the ceremony was over, it started raining again. And that night, it rained so hard, the Supreme Court gardens flooded, and so did the freeway. It was one of the heaviest storms to hit Perth. Not many people came, not so many people as we expected came from that ceremony. When I asked them, "Where were you?" I said, you went ahead with that ceremony. He said, "Of course we did. Wasn't it raining?" Because to the east, to the west, to the north, to the south, there was a storm. And trees were coming down. Branches were across the roads. The rain was lashing. And people just could not believe. We went ahead with that ceremony. Because in Supreme Court Gardens, just kilometres south of here, it did not rain. I remember, again, one of the, and after, when it stopped raining, that monk shut up. He never spoke to me. That was Eiko Ihari. Sorry?
Has Deva stopped doing
anything? Oh, sure, yeah. They sorted it out for us, made sure it happened. Because that was really weird. Even there was one TV camera came there from Channel 31, it's a community station, and the girl was going around saying, "This is," she used the word eerie, "this is eerie, this is eerie." And she kept on saying this. And the guy who loaned the tents to us was really surprised too we didn't cancel. And he sent an email which was sent to me, "Can you please tell us the horse races?" He was really impressed. And that was a great day, because it actually shows what can actually happen. And I remember just, we had this big Buddha statue which we had to carry and carry back again. And I was just so wiped out. And the following morning I had to go to Sydney for another Waisak. And I remember just going there in the early, to the airport, and I hardly slept, and going there, and then checking in, and just so wiped out and tired. Even though I'd rested, I was still really tired. And I went to the corner, and I had the program. It was the first time I'd had a chance to open it. As soon as I opened it, I just started crying. And that was a time when just the emotion of this day was stopping this rainstorm, and just what we achieved, it really hit me. And then actually the Thai ambassador came and found me and invited me up into the Qantas lounge for a cup of tea. But that was really inspiring, because there was something which was very, very weird and strange. So that was with aditanas there, strong aditanas. And then you can use that power, but you only use that power every now and again for good things. You don't use the aditana for the stock market to go up, especially in your share. But yeah, there are such things as Davis. But you know that I'm a theoretical physicist before I was a monk, and I don't believe in these things lightly. I know that about a year ago, all these people from all over the place, in Singapore and here in Australia as well, were going around with these photographs on their digital cameras with these little dots on them, or these little smudges on them. And they were going around saying, "Oh look, Devas, Devas, Devas." And I remember going to KL, and this, in front of the temple there was this big picture of a monk with one of these little very faint ones, Deva so-called lights on it, and a big donation bowl underneath for him. It was crazy. And those aren't Deva lights. And it was always a bit suspicious, because sometimes they appeared in pubs. No sort of proper Deva, no one with self-respect would be in a pub. And they're just actually just part of the what happens when you do a digital photograph, especially with a flash. It's just a dust particle being ionized by the light. No more than that. And you can have a look at a website, a whole big website on orbs, ORBS. But still some people think, oh look, it's the Deva light. And as soon as they take a picture of a mark, they always look, where's the Deva light? And they get so excited. But it's not Deva light. So some of these things is just superstition. But some of the things are real. And what convinced me, this is my Deva, one of the Deva stories. Let's have a couple of Deva stories. The best Deva story. And this is actually a real Dinky Dye Deva story. A real solid one. Nothing really superstitious. This is a great story. It's absolutely true. I checked it out. And I know the monk actually who's involved in this. But many years ago, there was an American young man who had been working in the Peace Corps of Thailand, and after completing his stint in the Peace Corps, he wanted to become a monk, a Buddhist monk. But he did not know how you become a monk. And he was staying in a cheap hotel in Bangkok, so he asked the maitre d', not the maitre, wasn't that the concierge, not the maitre d', maitre d' is in the restaurant, show you how much I know about these things. About the concierge, he asked the concierge, you know, I want to become a monk, what do you do? You know, how do you do this and where do I go? And so the concierge actually told him that in one of the monasteries in the middle of Bangkok called Wat Bawon, that they sometimes found some Western monks there. Because, you know, the Ajahn Chah's monastery is outside, and that's where, you know, our monks are. But every now and again, you have some Western monks in Wat Bawon, which is very, very close to the centre of Bangkok, very close to the royal field, the Sonam Luang. So the concierge gave him instructions how to get there, and he said, what you should do is get some food, doesn't matter what, wait outside, and then put some food in the monk's bowl. And once you put the food in the monk's bowl, then ask him, say, I want to become a monk. And then the monk will actually sort of take you inside, or tell you to wait, and take you inside later, and, you know, get you started on training to be a monk. It wasn't exactly the right piece of advice, but that's all he got. And so he got a taxi early in the morning with some food, and the taxi dropped him outside of Wat Bawon, but it was too early. The monks weren't going to come out for a couple of hours, and the street was deserted. He got the time wrong. And so he was walking up and down this road outside of Wat Bawon. The whole monastery was locked up. And hardly anyone was around. He didn't know what to do. And then this man approached him and asked him in very good English. He said, no, what are you doing here? Why are you walking up and down? And he said, well, you know, this is, I was in the Peace Corps. I just completed my service and I want to be a monk. This is what I was told to do. And the fellow said, look, you're far too early. The monks don't come out for another hour and a half yet. But the man said, look, it doesn't matter, because, you know, I've got the key. I'll let you inside and show you around. And, you know, and then I'll let you know out. I'll let you know where to stand when the monks come out and their arms around. So he got out the set of keys and opened the gate and took him inside, opened the door to the main hall. You know, it's the main Uposatha hall where they do ordinations, the Sema hall. And he led him inside, turned on the lights. And then for the next hour or so, he started to explain all the murals, the paintings on the walls of this temple. If you've ever been to a traditional temple in Thailand, you see all the walls got all these paintings on. And sometimes, you know, even I, sometimes you have to work out exactly what story that is and what it is. But this Thai guy, he knew everything. He knew exactly what was what. He was a mine of information. He even actually described who actually sponsored that particular panel. And why they sponsored it, because, you know, that somebody had died, or because they were did well in some business or whatever. And he said it was just so interesting when this guy was explaining all of the paintings and drawings on the wall. And when he finished, he said, it's good timing, in about 10 minutes the monks are going to come out, and one of the monks over there, an old monk, he will come out, this is what he looks like, stand over there and put your food in and ask him, you know, can I be a monk? And he will look after you. He's the guy to ask. So he went over and stood over there while the Thai guy locked up, turned off the lights. And sure enough, 10 minutes later, the monks came out, and this one monk, who was described by this Thai guy, He put food in that monk's bowl and said, I want to become a monk. He said, wait here, and took him inside later on and started the process of becoming a monk. You've got all these chanting to learn, and also you have to learn some of the ritual, what you've got to do, where you've got to stand, what you've got to say. And as many of you have seen monk ordinations at my monastery, it's exactly the same ceremony. But the trouble was, the young monk who they gave him to teach in the ceremony, his English wasn't that good. It was passable, but there were still too many things which he misunderstood. And so he said one day, can't I have another teacher to instruct me on all this ritual? And the fellow said, "But this is the best monk we have. He speaks the best English." And at that point, this guy said, well, what about that lay attendant who I met on the first day? He spoke perfect English. And the monk said, what lay attendant? There's no lay attendants here who speak perfect English. The guy who let me in that door. Can't let you in that door. Yes, he did. No, he can't. Because that door, and I know that door, if any of you have been to Bangkok, that door is the royal gate. It's only opened when kings go in to the main temple at Wat Bawon. Because that temple is where the royal family ordains. It's the royal temple. And as soon as he started talking like this, the monk dragged him to the abbot, straight away. The abbot, as he later became the Sangharaja of Thailand, he's very, very old now. But at that time he was fit and healthy, or reasonably healthy. And he started telling the story to the abbot of Wat Bawon. And not even the abbot knew all the history of those temple drawings. And so he stopped him and got his secretary and asked him to go back to the very beginning again. Because parts of that story don't make any sense. Number one, no one knows of that lay disciple who speaks perfect English wandering around at that time in the morning. The only people who have keys are the monks, the abbot, and maybe his secretary. I'm not quite sure who, but they don't give them to lay disciples. You cannot go through that door unless you're royalty. And also, you can't turn on the lights at that particular place. No one knew all those stories, not even the old abbot. The whole thing was very, very extraordinary. And then, having finished his story, they asked him, what did the guy look like? And he described him as wearing like the sort of Thai clothes they'd wore about a century ago. And when he was trying to describe the guy's face, he was looking around and he saw the fellow on the wall. That's him, that's him. It was a picture of one of the sponsors of Wat Bawon, King Rama V. That was a monk who we know. I won't tell you what his name is, he's still a monk. That's how he became a monk. A king who died over 100 years ago, I don't know exactly when, saw a young monk, a young monk-to-be, a Westerner, wandering outside one of the big monasteries in Bangkok, and decided to help him out. He could open that gate because he was a king. He knew all the stories of those paintings because he was there at the time. He was one of the builders of that hall, or rather the sponsors. And he was still looking after sort of young men who wanted to become monks. I've checked that story out, not only in Thailand, but I remember telling that to the Thai ambassador in Singapore. And he was nodding and said, yeah, I know that story, that's part of the history of that temple. Many people know about it. No, it's a deva. Deva come down to help. But the interesting thing is that real devas, they don't wear wings and little halos on top of them. That sometimes that you can't see that they're anything different than another human being. They look exactly the same. It's only he had the old clothes on. That's the only thing which made him look a bit strange. But other than that, you don't really know if the person sitting next to you is a deva or not. Well, that's a great story, because that's a solid one, not sort of, you know, seeing it in a vision in your meditation or dreaming about it, but actually seeing a real solid person, talking to them, being with them for an over an hour. And then recognize them. Being an American, he didn't know sort of who King Rama V was. And then, because he's obviously a sponsor, had a picture of him on the wall. And he just noticed, oh, it's him. So it's a great story. So there are things like Davis. But and sometimes they can help you. But only if you're doing something really, really worthwhile. So, 30th anniversary. And a WASAC night, obviously, you know, the day was okay, we'll help out. Okay, so, fascinating. I've got a lot of stories here. I better carry on. Please tell us more about nimittas. What are they? In what way do they manifest? How precisely can they be used to bring us into jhana? I'll do that in a talk, probably not tomorrow, because I think I'll be your talk on metta tomorrow, but maybe the day after. I'll talk about nimittas and how to get into jhanas. Can you please elaborate on right effort? Does it mean being hard working and meditating 24/7? That's not right effort. That's right wrong conceit. Controlling. Now, the Buddha was very... Well, I shouldn't really say this, but is obviously, he was just incredibly smart. The way he described things was just brilliant. When he said right effort, it was defined as whatever works. Whatever needs to be done to abandon unwholesome states, if unwholesome states aren't there yet, to keep them out, to develop positive states, now wholesome states, and to maintain them once they arise. Now it's actually what works, that's right effort. And having said that, you can experiment if you like. What creates or generates unwholesome states? And already you know, if you strive and struggle and control and expect to make goals for yourself and say, I'm going to do this, is there any wholesome states come out of that in your meditation? Do you get anywhere? In life you do. This is what I'm talking about with respect to meditation. You find the more you struggle, the more you suffer. However, the many of you have had the courage to follow some of the instructions here, and have you actually found it does actually work? When you really start letting go, you just allow things to be, you don't struggle. It's amazing just how the mind can get so still and peaceful and happy and focused and energized, and insights start coming. So actually you can see, yes, this is what creates wholesome states and abandons unwholesome ones. The path of letting go, of renouncing. I don't mean renouncing all your wealth. I'm renouncing your doer, your controller, letting things be. The loving kindness, the door of my heart is open to this moment, as it is. Being contented, easily satisfied, not demanding in nature, what we chant so many times. Those things work. Now that's the right effort. And as you know, it's not easy to do because it goes against your habits. That's why it's effort is needed at first to do nothing. You think that it's a lazy type of meditation. But if you do laziness, the mind wanders all over the place and you just carry on your old habits. Laziness and doing nothing is two completely different things. Laziness is just following the old habits. The right effort of letting go takes a lot of mindfulness, a lot of care, a lot of training. But it's not the effort which you're used to. It's a far more refined effort. And this is actually why we sort of call it right effort. It's a difficult thing to understand, but you'll know it by its results. That's why I've been telling a few people that part of mindfulness and part of insight is that when you are meditating, you get instant feedback, or maybe feedback in the next few seconds. Whatever you do, or don't do, creates an effect in your mind. And your mindfulness should be sharp enough to know that the mind is getting agitated. Too many thoughts are coming up. It's not clear. It's not happy. It's a problem. And that means it's wrong effort. Can't be going in the right direction. other things you do, you find it gets peaceful, it gets easy, the mind becomes clear, the breath becomes easy to watch. You know that that must have been right effort. That's how you learn. And as you learn by your own experience, not through the theories, but your own experience, that's called insight. You're understanding through your own experience what meditation is and how it works and how the mind gets into these wholesome qualities. You know exactly what letting go is and why the Buddha taught like this. So that's right effort with mindfulness and insight as well, how they all go together. So the feedback mechanism is so powerful. You call it trial and error. But with mindfulness, you're alert to see what happens after you do something or don't do something, and you soon learn. And that way you don't waste so much time and you become a very efficient meditator. You know, this actually works. Whoopee. So that's what right effort is. Is there any comment on that? That really sort of confused me for years. Because I always thought, because as a Westerner, right effort means you give everything you've got. 100%. I'm going to get enlightened no matter what. One of my stories on Waysack was, I think it might be the first or second Waysack I went to. I was still a university student. And the monk, he was actually Dr. Salatissa, a very well-known monk who was in England for many years. He came up to take the Waysack ceremony for Cambridge University Buddhist Society. So I was there, and during the day I was getting more and more inspired. I was a young Buddhist, like bright-eyed, oh, this is amazing, this is wonderful. And then they read out the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, sitting under the Bodhi tree. And after he sat on the Bodhi tree, made this resolution that even if my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up, I'm not going to move from this seat until I become fully enlightened. I remembered that. And when I went back to my room, I sat on my seat and I said, well, if the Buddha can do it, I can do it. And he was only an Indian guy. You know, I'm at Cambridge University. I'm smart. So I thought, right, this is it. And I was serious. I was deadly sort of sincere. I sat down there and I made this earth-shaking resolution. I am not going to move from my cushion. It wasn't even a sofa, it was a cushion off the sofa. I'm not going to move from this cushion until I too get complete enlightenment, even though my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up. I don't care. I'm at enlightenment. Oh, yeah. And those days I could maybe 25 minutes meditate. That was my max. Sometimes I could manage 30 minutes. And I got to 40 this time. And I was in absolute agony. I couldn't stand it any longer. I still wasn't enlightened when I opened my eyes. And I was even more disappointed when I saw my blood hadn't dried up and my bones were still in one piece. That's a stupid young guy who thinks, yeah, willpower will do it for you. Willpower will not do it. Willpower is coming from ego, from conceit. How can you destroy or overcome, transcend ego with such stupid wrong effort when it's coming from will? And when you understand it, it's obvious that that's not the way you become enlightened. So you have to be more wise, have a bit more insight, a bit more sensitivity and mindful, because this is a subtle path. When you really understand what's going on, you understand what willpower is, or what right effort is rather, is actually a letting go of things, an abandonment, a freeing, an opening of the heart. That's what right effort is. It's very different than what people think in the world is right effort, which is struggling. Is nimitta a mind-created object? It actually is the mind, but I'll talk about that when I talk about nimittas in a couple of days' time.
Yeah. Eons and eons and eons, so many lives, time, we have to keep on up to the other thing.
Ah, here we go about the story of the Buddha. Now, you already heard me this morning sort of challenging accepted wisdom. And that's probably what you heard in Sunday school when you were a little baby Buddhist, about all of these trying really hard and having all these lifetimes of developing the spiritual qualities. But again, when I started reading the sutta, and you read it, read Gatikara Sutta. Gatikara Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It doesn't matter about any quirks or translations, because it's the story which is important, not one or two words. That story was of Gatikara, which actually means like pot maker. He was a potter, and it was the story was told by our Buddha, and he said Gatikara lived in the time of the previous Buddha, Kassapa. And Gatikara was, he had four jhanas, he was an anagami, a non-returner, he wore white, and the only reason he didn't become a monk under Kassapa was because his parents were blind and were very old, and he was the only one who could look after them. But they described, and this is actually one of the beautiful descriptions of what it's like to be a lay non-returner. What's expected of you? What your character would be? He said the only reason he couldn't become a monk was because he had to look after his parents. But he still, the jhanas were easy for him. And he was celibate. And he wore white. And because he was a potter and needed clay, he would not dig the earth in case he would injure any little animals who lived in the earth. He'd actually wait for the rats or the rabbits to dig out the earth from their holes, or until farmers had made their rice fields and there was some earth or clay left over from making the dikes and the paddy fields. And he'd collect that and he'd make his pots from that, the leftover clay. And even though he had to support himself and his parents, he would never sell anything. He had nothing to do with money. And that's a great teaching for, you know, some of our modern day monks who still have bank accounts and keep money. Even an anagami layperson would not take money. He wouldn't sell his pots. He'd just put a sign up there, anyone who wants a pot, please take one. If you want to leave some lentils and rice, please leave lentils and rice, not money. It's a simple form of barter, but no price. Take what you want, leave what you want. And that's actually the level of a person who's left the world. Now the main part of that story was Gatikara had a best friend called Jyotipala the Brahmin. And Jyotipala the Brahmin was not at all interested in religion, especially that shaven-headed, good-for-nothing fellow called Kassapa, who happened to be a Buddha. And you see that Jyotipala starting to talk like that about Kassapa. You know, he's just a waste of time. He doesn't know anything. He's just a shaven-headed, bald-headed, good-for-nothing. That's not exactly what he said, but those are the sort of Pali words. You know, basically it's rough meaning. And the first part of this sutta, that Gatikara tried all sorts of ways of trying to get his best friend to actually to see the Buddha. You know what it's like sometimes you try and get your friends or maybe your partner to come to the temple and see a good monk or see a good nun. And there's just sometimes they just will not go. So you have to use a bit of tricks and reverse psychology or whatever to try and get them to come there. And that was what it was like with Gatikara, the anagami, great disciple of the previous Buddha Kassapa, trying to get Jyotipala to come and at least see Kassapa. And eventually he managed to get him to come there. Actually, he grabbed hold of his hair. Just after they went for a bath, he grabbed hold of his hair and started pulling him. And those of you who come from Asian culture, you're not supposed to touch the top of the hair. That's forbidden. You know, you don't touch the top part. And when he did this, Jyotipala was saying, "What are you doing? You know, you're supposed to know, you should know better than that. You can't do that, but you're my best friend." And then it got very clear to Jyotipala, his best friend was that desperate to get him to see this Kassapa fellow, that he would actually break all the social norms of the time. So he said, "Well, this Kassapa must be something. Okay, I will go." And so Jyotipala eventually went to see Kassapa, the previous Buddha, and as soon as he saw him and listened to a discourse, he realized his big mistake. This was somebody really special. And so, not only did he become a Buddhist, but he actually ordained, became a monk with Kassapa the Buddha. And then the story goes off on a tangent on another story. And it doesn't mention Jyotipala, who became a monk under the Buddha, having scolded him and scorned him beforehand. Except at the very end of the teaching. At the end of the teaching, our Buddha Sakyamuni or Gotama, whichever you wish to call him, when he was sort of finished the point he was going to make, which was something different, he said, in that time, I was Jyotipala, who became a monk under the previous Buddha, who had scolded a previous Buddha, who couldn't even recognize the previous Buddha, until he had to almost be dragged there by his best friend. And in the Devaputta Sanghita, one of the little stories there is Gatikara, Anagami, still alive at the enlightenment of our Buddha in the pure abodes, came down to congratulate Sakyamuni. And in his little poem, Gatikara, now long died when it was Gatikara the potter, but now a deva in the Sudawasa, where the Anagamis go, gave this little poem, saying, congratulations, we used to live in the same village before under Kasapa the Buddha. You went forth, I was already an Anagami. Confirming that little story. But the best part of that, there was a life of our Buddha, very, very recent, according to the cosmic many, many eons. And the person who was about to be Sakyamuni Buddha was so stupid he couldn't recognize another Buddha when it was right in front of him. So much for developing spiritual qualities over many, many eons. There is a snapshot of a Buddha very, very, very close to his final life. So that goes against, completely negates this whole idea of this long, 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 long practice, which actually came from the Mahayana idea of Bodhisattva.
So we have a good chance.
You have perfect chance. But I love challenging this accepted wisdom. And actually when you start challenging it, you get closer to the heart of what Buddhism is. And it's alive. You can do it. I know that in Sri Lanka, for a long time, people say, you can't even become a Sowan these days. You can't even become a stream winner. What's the point? You might as well become a Christian or something. At least you can drink then. But the point is, I hope they're not sort of bugging this. But the point is, you can and you do. So give everything you've got, it's possible. This is a great question. Ajahn, I started practicing goodwill in my meditation. Am I on the right path? At last. It's always goodwill. What's the opposite of goodwill? It's ill will. And don't do any ill will. So goodwill towards yourself and towards other beings, goodwill towards your breath, goodwill towards your bed, goodwill towards everything. If you've got goodwill, then you're engaged, you're happy, you're at peace, you've got not so much business when you have goodwill. You have ill will, you're creating a big problem for you. So have goodwill, good, virtuous movement of the mind. And if you actually just focus on the beautiful and get a little bit of happiness in the day, then the meditation goes. There's another great teaching of the Buddha that stillness of mind comes from happiness. It does not come from grumpiness. If you're grumpy, fault-finding, negative, you've had enough, never will you get any deep meditation. The happy people get meditation. So, develop a little bit of happiness. Have a bit of fun. Will caffeine affect one's meditation? Vitamin C. It's very good for your health, vitamin C. Vitamin caffeine. It does. You've got to, just like anything else, you've just got to balance. You know, balance your intake of food, of drink, of tea and coffee, whatever, sugar or honey, whatever you take. And now, I'm addicted to tea. But it's not my fault, because I was born in London. And you actually have tea just when you come off the mother's milk, you go on to your father's tea. The first thing we used to do when we got up in the morning was make a cup of tea. And as kids, that was our first duty to our parents, to make the tea. And they wouldn't get up until the tea was brewed in the pot. And you'd have so many different cups of tea during the day, and the last thing you do before you went to bed at night, have a cup of tea. And it was just such a part of British culture that when Ajahn Chah went to England, and when he came back and we asked him, what was it like in England? Did you learn any English? He said, yes, I learned one word. He said this entire. The only word he learned in English was cup of tea. It made us so laugh because he heard it so many times. That's the only word he remembered. Cup of tea. So, you know, just it gets addicted in your system. But every now and again I give it up just to make sure I can. But it's such a small thing. So it doesn't really affect your meditation unless you take too much. And obviously if you take too much caffeine or too much tea or anything like that, you just get, your eyes start to bulge and you never get any meditation. You just go thinking around in sort of violent circles. So just balance it. If you're used to it, okay, but if it makes you sort of lose sleep, then it's not good for you. Could you please explain how chanting at sutras can be effective? Sutta like Ratana Sutta, Dajaka Sutta, and Gudimala Sutta for pregnant women, and for Dajaka Sutta. Actually, I did tell you the story about the CEO and I think I did the first night, wasn't it, about how it was shown that in Taiwan, if you do chanting about the ducks.
No.
Didn't say that? Okay, because I did this at our Katina ceremony this year. Because at our Katina ceremony, that we were raising funds for our retreat centre. But it wasn't just raising funds for the retreat centre next to our monastery. We also had our local council were there. The mayor was there, the deputy mayor, and also the CEO of the Shire. But they mostly come every year. And 2 days after that Katina, they were going to vote on the planning approval for our retreat centre. So obviously we were very keen to make sure that everything went well. Otherwise, no retreat centre. Because they have the power there. They can say no very easily, and it's a lot of trouble to try and get them to reverse their decision. So during the ceremony, before the ceremony, when the people came, I said hello to the mayor and the deputy and also the CEO, and I noticed actually she came with a baby. She'd just given birth a couple of weeks before, and she actually came the year before. So I saw my opportunity. During the talk beforehand, I mentioned some research which had been done in Taiwan. That in Taiwan, they have found that a duck usually lays an egg once every 10 days, on average. But they played Buddhist chanting to these ducks, and they started laying an egg once every 8 days. So obviously the Buddhist chanted made these ducks more fertile, more productive. Having said that story, saying, here's the proof, the CEO of our local shire, she came here last year, she's come back again, she's had a baby because of the chanting. It's the monk's fault. So they thought that was funny, thank goodness. And they gave us our planning permission. So if you listen to too much chanting, you have babies. It works for ducks. Why does it work for you? But anyway, how it can be effective. The best part of the chanting is actually if you know what you're chanting. The Ratana Sutra is brilliant. It's got some amazing Dhamma in there. Look, one of the sentences that I always like is the last word, Kinang Puranang Nawang Nati Sambo Wang Virata Chitayati Kabel Wasani. Take Kina Bija Awulhi Chanda Nibanti Dira Yatayang Padipa. Kinang Puranang, the past has been destroyed. Kinang Puranang Nawang Nati Sambawang, the future will never come into being. Wirata Chitayati Kabel Wasani, the mind is freed from existence. Nibanti Dira, it's certain to be extinguished, just like that candle. The last verse of the Ratana Sutta. And it's one of the ones I quote, because Nibbanti, that's a word like it, Nibbanas. You know, Nibbanas is using an anglicization of, you know, to achieve Nibbana. In Pali, it's Nibbanti. So that candle, when it goes out tonight, it Nibbanas. And that there was actually a beautiful teaching of what Nibbana is. and how past destroyed, future can't come to be. This mind is free of existence, just like that candle's going to go out. Brilliant little teaching, incredibly deep. But a lot of times people just chant and haven't got a clue what they're chanting. That's a powerful, powerful teaching. So I love things like that. When you know the Pali, when you're chanting, you get really inspired. For example, you've got the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the teaching of non-self. Ah, that's a second sutta, second teaching. Second sort of teaching of the Buddha. And that was where everyone became enlightened. The first teaching, Dhammacakka Sutta, they just became stream winners. Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, that was it. Arahats, the whole lot. First five disciples. What's the heart of that teaching? About the five khandhas. The body, feelings, perceptions, mind. Will and consciousness. The five khandhas. And the Buddha says, this is just summary, he said, say for example, consciousness. He said, consciousness is not me, not mine, not a self. If it was a self, you'd be able to say, oh, may my consciousness be like this, or may my consciousness be like that. But because it's not you, it's not yours, you can't tell it what to do. Same with your will, with your feelings, with your perceptions. Because feelings or perceptions, your happiness, your pain doesn't belong to you, you can't tell it what to do. Well, how do you meditate? Are you telling your consciousness what to do? Come on, get into jhana. Come on, stop thinking. Come on, sort of have some happiness. The Buddha is saying in that sutta, you can't do that. You can try, but you'll never achieve it. Because it's not under your control. Your body belongs to nature, so does your mind. It does not belong to you. You try and tell it what to do, and most of the time you just get absolutely frustrated. And that's the heart of that first sutta. That second teaching of the Buddha. Basically it's saying, you're out of control. Nothing belongs to you. Not even your mind. So you might as well say, none of my business. And then you're arahat, enlightened. Can you say that? This whole retreat is none of your business. You can't control it. Just leave it all alone. Don't even try to meditate. Don't even try to do anything. Just give up. Stop. Can you do that? Of course you can't. That's why we have to take you slowly into such things. And that's a powerful, powerful teaching. It makes you cry when you sort of listen to that and you understand what it means. Brilliant. That's actually, when you do such chanting, it's really good. When you understand its meaning. But it's just like words, you know, just sounds. It's just like a parrot can be chanting. You don't know what you're chanting. Sometimes it's funny, sometimes when you do sort of chanting and people ask me to chant for them, you don't know what I'm saying. I could be saying, may you just drop dead and die. And I hate your guts. You're so stingy. You don't know what I'm chanting, but you still say, oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu at the end of it.
Bad news for me, Sydney.
Here in Bhante, Bodhisattva, Abhivadana Sri Sri Champa, Isam Buddha Pachaya, no? That is the chant that monks say at the end of it, and we all.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Do you know what it means?
So that means the meaning doesn't mean that it is. It's a wish.
Yeah.
Say that you are a respectful person and honor the elder, you'll be fairer and heavier and happier and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they are wishing you happiness.
Did
I say something?
No, it did. We just say cause and effect. If you behave yourself, you get to make good karma, then things happen. So, what power does a monk have to alter the law of karma? That would be like fraud. That would be like politicians, you know, being unfair. So really, no one should really interfere too much with the law of karma. If you want to be happy, fair, prosperous, then you have to do it. So anyone who wants to be rich, and they ask me, and I say, work hard, spend little.
I suppose it's the case when the monks, actually they go to the
I chant Metta Sutta because I don't care if anybody else understands it. I understand what I'm chanting. And I use that actually to spread loving kindness to the person who's died.
So is that the only chant?
I just chant I did today. Sometimes we do the Anicca Sankara. It gives us a powerful chant. It's not just this body, but all compounded things, including your mind, is impermanent. Anicca Sankara. Upada Vayadam, whatever arises, fades away. Everything, your jhanas, your wisdom, everything. Not just your body, but your mind as well. Or your intelligence. You know, you're a doctor there. How many years did it take to learn all of that? You're going to forget it soon. Alzheimer's is on the way. And all of that you learn is just gone.
And then I suppose we have a chant every day, all the time. That's not going to be another day.
Yeah, indeed, that's right. And if you want Sankara, part of whatever, Upajita Vandira Janti, whatever arises will cease. What arises, your will arises. It will just fade away to absolute nothing. Your consciousness arises. That too will cease. It will not persist. So never think you are the one who knows, because that disappears. It's gone. And the last verse, Tezang Vipassama Sukha. The calming. Vipassama is a synonym for samatha. The calming, the stilling of all of those things which arise is happiness. It's what I've been teaching all week. Stilling is bliss. Tezang Vipassama Sukha. Brilliant little teaching in a nutshell. What Buddhism is all about. Calming the sankharas. That's calming the body, calming the thought, calming time, calming the will, stopping so everything becomes absolutely still. And that's not blanking out. The Buddha said that's bliss. That is sukha, happiness. Brilliant teaching. So that's also what we do. Oh, I've got hands coming up. I'm not going to finish these questions, never mind. Yes, no, actually, you're first. The reason is because traditionally the Angulimala, he'd just become enlightened. And that's amazing that a person like that could become enlightened, a serial killer. So if he could become enlightened, surely you can, Nirantula. Have you killed anybody yet? You're not a serial killer. I've known you for a long time. You're okay. So if he could become enlightened, how come you guys can't? You know how he became enlightened? The Buddha said, stop. I've stopped, Angulimala, you stop. Great word. Stop. Stop thinking. Stop moving. Stop the mind. That's a great teaching. And of course, Angulimala understood it and stopped and became an arahat. But then afterwards he, you know, saw this woman in labour and he came back and said, oh, it's just so sad that she's hurting so much. And the Buddha said, oh, go back to her and just make this asseveration, like an aditana, saying, ever since I was born, I've never harmed any human being. And then he goes, I can't say that's a lie. I'm a serial killer. And then the Buddha, obviously, you said, ever since I've been born as a noble one, I've never harmed anybody. And the point was, that had immense power, because that's Angulimala, a serial killer, saying that. So if you're a serial killer, and you now become an arahat, now that chant works. Because that's an amazing thing, that a serial killer can become an arahat, the day was just, well, amazing, you have to do something for that, that's powerful. But because it worked for Angulimala, people think it will work for you. And you're not an arahat, nor are you a serial killer, so both conditions are not there. Which is why sometimes those things don't work. Okay. I've got two more questions, yeah. Yes, Kemanti first, and then put it. Anumodana. All anumodana is actually just acknowledging that a person has done a good act of karma, and just say, well, you've done a good act of karma, you've given a donation, you've given food to the monks, or you've kept your precepts, you know, you've meditated, and saying, well done. When you do things like this, you're going to get sort of karmic consequences of goodness. That's all the Anumodana is. It's actually describing a natural process. No, actually what it really means is we have yatawari waha, which means that just as the rain falls on the mountains and it goes down onto the rivers, fills up the lakes and then goes from the lakes into the big rivers and then down to the oceans, just the same way that the karma you do here will actually, if you determine it, will flow down to someplace else, to your deceased relations. You know, it's like the water flowing from one place to another. And we usually just pour the water out as we do that. To actually to emphasize the point that water's going from one place to another place. Your good karma is going from you to another being. So it's a symbolic which has meaning, but if you say it or you don't say it, doesn't really matter. It's what's in your heart is important.
So it's not that you're sharing with
you're actually pouring it out to other people. You are, yes. But the child is not doing it, it's your intention does it. The child is irrelevant. Sorry?
So you can make other people's karma different?
Yes, by your determination to do so. Yes, Patricia?
Basically, you said that you can't tell your mind what to do. It doesn't belong to you.
Yeah.
However, for the last week, I've been using the power of suggestion to let go.
Yeah, okay, but you're actually telling it not to do things. And that works because you're telling it to just to let go, to disengage. And sort of, it does that because, you know, it's a suggestion, you try it and it works, it makes you happy, and it's the remembrance of the happiness, the bliss, the freedom, which will work much more powerfully than any suggestion in the future. Your mind will do it because it wants to, not because you tell it. Okay. So, it's a long evening. Is vegetarian a must for practicing Buddhists? Does it help to progress in the Eightfold Path, knowing very well that millions of insects are killed in the modern world to produce food that are not of animal origin? Thank you. Yeah, it's a big debate, vegetarian or non-vegetarian. It's not that important. The Buddha ate meat. That's very, very clear. And he was fully enlightened. If you can be vegetarian, that's even better, because that shows a lot of compassion. But it's not absolutely necessary, but it's good if you can do it. Ah, how does vegetarian a must for practicing Buddhists? Does it? No, it's not absolutely a must. It's a maybe, can do. This is not a question, it is an essay, so I'm sort of leave that over. So it'll take too much time to read. The talk this morning reminded me of the story of the 100 bat offering that you had created. Hang on. The talk this morning reminded me of the story of the 100 bat offering you had that created desire for things that you lived happily without beforehand. It sounded like a PR promotion for Get Those Jhanas. Again, the hamster wheel of desire. When you get them, is it like heaven, the movie ending Happy Ever After? Can you give further insight? The 100 bat offering. Baht! Oh, the 100 baht. You get a bat being offered. 100 baht offering. Okay, yeah. It's true. It's got a great question there. If you desire the jhanas, you will never get them. The jhanas are the result of letting go. That's actually why that sometimes people object. Say you can become attached to the jhanas. And so people get very afraid. Don't do the jhanas, it's more attachment. The point is, you can't get attached to states of letting go. It's the oxymoron again, you're getting attached to letting go. It makes no sense when you understand what jhanas actually are. But the Buddha actually said, not attachment, he said, but if you indulge in the jhanas, if you do them many, many times, and this is again one of my favorite quotes, when I came across this reading of the sutras, I thought, wow! That answers all those people who say that jhanas should be avoided. Because the Buddha said that anyone who indulges in the jhanas, they can expect only one of four things. This is the result of indulging in jhanas, doing lots of them, again and again. Only one of four things can happen to you. And those four things, the only four consequences of indulging in jhanas, is stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or arahat. That's in the Pasarika Sutta, Digha Nikaya. Basically, it's saying that that's what happens if you do jhanas. You ever become a stream winner, wise returner, non returner, or arahat, and that is the word of the Buddha. Direct. So, if you want those jhanas, you will never get them. It's a great question, because if I don't talk about the jhanas, again you won't get them. If I talk about them too often, it encourages desire. Yeah, I've heard these, I want them. It's good to actually to know they're there. It's good to know exactly what they are, stages of letting go. Once you understand they're there, they're important, and also what they are, you know how they are achieved. Not through wanting, but through stilling, through stopping. Please always remember that. This is what happens when you really let go, you still the mind, you stop, you abandon the controller, and you just wait patiently, and the mind slows down and stops. The same way when you turn off the fuel from your car, you run out of petrol, what happens? It stops. Eventually, you don't actually, it's not that the car wants to stop, or it says that that's my goal, I'm going to stop. Whether it thinks it's going to stop or doesn't want to stop, whatever it wills, it's going to stop. It's just cause and effect. It's irrelevant to what you will or what you don't will. If you just turn off the gas, the craving, the control, what drives you, then the mind slows down and stops. And that's called jhanas. It stops even more, just goes through the jhanas, more and more stopping until it stops completely. And that's called cessation. Great question. So, jhanas are there, but please don't want them. Still the mind, create the causes. And once the causes are in place, the jhanas just happen. Is it important to have the spinal cord straight and upright to get into deep meditation? If so, why? No, it's not important. When Ajahn Chah was in a coma, when he was reaching fourth jhana stage, was he lying down? I think he was lying down. Posture is not so important. You've got to find the best posture for you. These days, people played sport, they had motorbike accidents or car accidents. We've always got a few broken bones in there somewhere, if we get to manage to last this long. And so that your spine has had many injuries, and so you sit how you find it's comfortable for you. You can sit in a chair, you can lean against the wall, you can even lay on your bed. Because once I had a typhus fever, and I was really fed up, because at that time they didn't realize it was typhus fever, they thought it was typhoid, but that didn't work, and they tried all sorts of antibiotics. And I was in this hospital in the northeast of Thailand. It was a third world country, and it was the hospital in the backwaters of a third world country, and I was in the monk's ward, which was the backwaters of a backwater hospital in the third world country. And so it was absolutely so primitive. And I tell the story that the first night I was there, with a fever, feeling terrible. At 6 o'clock, the nurse disappeared, and at 7 o'clock, the replacement hadn't come yet. And so I turned around to the monk in my next bed and said, "Now, where's the night nurse? You know, should we call someone? They haven't arrived." And they turned around, "There is no night nurse. If something happens in the middle of the night, that's just bad karma." And that was not very reassuring for me. Because I was used to like Western, where there's always somebody there to call or look after you. And there's a ward of about 20 beds. The monk's in all sorts of stages of incipient death, including me. And there's no doctor, no nurse, no bell, nothing to call. And if you died, that was it. Tough luck. You should have sort of got sick during the daytime when somebody was there. And that was the sort of hospital it was. And worse than that, because they didn't really know exactly what you had, twice a day they'd shoot you up with these antibiotics, and they'd shoot it up in your buttocks. And the worst part of it was, those were the days of not disposable needles. You recycled them. And they were used in Bangkok, first of all, to the expensive hospitals. And then they were shipped out to the provinces to be reused, because the provinces were really poor. So they used them in the main wards in these provincial hospitals. And last of all, they used them on the monks, because we were supposed to be the tough guys. And they were blunt. And every time, twice a day, when you were injecting your buttocks, this nurse would come in, and she was built like a water buffalo, because she had to be. She had to be strong to actually to stab you. And that, I mean, that really hurt. And even though I was supposed to be a tough man, I started to really have a lot of ill will towards that nurse. Every time I was like, oh no, damn it. And so my buttocks were really sore. And not only that, you had the fever, you really felt weak. And I remember just going to the toilet, which was the end of the ward. Maybe the ward was about this size, and actually pretty much the same size as this room here. And it took about half an hour. You had to just, no one would help you, because there's no one there to help you. And you had to sort of somehow stand up, and your just legs were so weak, and you'd lunge for the next bed and grab hold of the rail and steady yourself after another 5 minutes to move to the next rail. And it took, you know, half an hour to actually move to the toilet. And when you sat down on that, not squat down on the toilet, you stay there until you were finished, because you didn't want to do that too many times a day. No bedpans. And I felt terrible in that hospital. I remember one day feeling so bad, and I thought, yes, I can't stand this. It's just, you were aching, you were sore, no one was looking after you, nothing was working. And those of you who had fever, you just noticed you've got absolutely no energy left at all. So I decided, come on, do some meditation. So I did letting go meditation on the breath. I went into this beautiful state of mind, and it was just so wonderful. Imagine like getting into a bliss state now, but when you're in a bliss state and before you're in like fevers and tiredness, this was such a great contrast. I was just so happy to get into a bliss state. And when I came out afterwards, it was the first relief you'd had in weeks of the aches and the pains. The one thing I noticed, that my posture, I was all over the place. A leg was over here, an arm was over there. But actually that proved to me, that's the reason why I say it now, you don't have to have a vertical spine to get into deep meditation. You don't have to be sitting in full lotus. You can have a leg over here or an arm over there. I wish I'd taken a photograph of that posture and put it in a book. This is the posture you need to get into jhanas. Because that's actually what happens. It's really great for the... So whatever you're comfortable, it's what your mind does is more important than what the body's up to. Question, has one got to achieve all four jhanas in order to become at least a stream enterer? Try to work out the minimum one needs to get guaranteed maximum 7 miles. This is called efficiency. Just one jhana is enough. First jhana is enough. In for full enlightenment. You just need that sort of, you know, that bit of understanding of what it's like outside the pond for a tadpole. Once you've got out the pond for the first time, if you've got sharp enough wisdom, if you're clever enough, then that's enough. What is upachara samadhi, i.e. neighborhood samadhi? Samadhi means the jhanas. Upachara means just before, just afterwards. And the reason why we have that, and that's a commentarial term, but that makes sense to me, because just before you get into a jhanas, the five hindrances have disappeared. You can actually see clearly, but the point is, before the jhana, that is very unstable. You're not really quite sure whether the hindrances have been dispelled or not. And because they may have been, they may not have been, what you see, what you sense, what you know, can be still distorted. So usually, if you're at upachara samadhi, there's nothing between you and jhanas. You can just go in, if you want to. There's no barrier left, the door's open. So when the door's open to jhana, that's called neighborhood, upachara. You're on the threshold of jhanas, so you can just go in. So the only time you know what that threshold is after you've been in jhanas, they're very easy to understand what they are. What is just before is threshold concentration or threshold stillness. But most importantly, what's after is also the threshold. When you go through a door, you cross the threshold on the way in and you cross it on the way out. And the point is the threshold, the neighborhood, the upachara, after the jhana, that's the one which is powerful. Because that lasts, and also you know that's what it is. And that's when the enlightenment wisdoms happen. The insights of post-jhana stillness. That's where enlightenment happens. That's why it's an important thing to understand. But it's the neighborhood concentration after emerging, which is the important one. beforehand, you can't be sure. Ajahn, you know you mentioned about setting your internal alarm clock to wake up, and you did say, if you're really tired, try to have a sleep a few times, now I've slept during the day. Each time I've woken up because of a nightmare, different ones. Aren't nightmares similar to what's worrying one? Nightmares are great. You know, people pay good money to go to horror movies. Like, you know, the Chainsaw Massacre, or Texas Chainsaw Massacre, isn't it? Or The Omen, or what are the other horror stories? But then you've got your own horror story delivered to you during the retreat, and you can't go to movies, so enjoy it. You've had a wonderful time there. No, I think you maybe have eaten too much cheese. Now, if you have a nightmare, and it keeps on recurring, then make a little resolution before you go to sleep at night. I'll sleep peacefully. Do a bit of loving kindness before you go to sleep. May my mind be peaceful and happy. May I be happy and well. May I sleep deeply and wake up refreshed. And try that, because what you take into sleep with you is usually you carry throughout that whole period. If you carry these beautiful thoughts before you go to sleep, you have these wonderful dreams. So condition your mind before you go to sleep, tell it exactly what you want to do, and it usually will do it. If jhana is central to the attainment of nirvana, then how did so many people become enlightened spontaneously upon hearing the teaching for the first time? It wasn't spontaneous. They had done the jhanas before. One of those is Bahiya. And Bahiya, he went to see the Buddha, and the Buddha told Bahiya, he said, please give me a quick teaching. And the Buddha gave him the teaching of, in the seen there will be only the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the sensed only the heard, in the cognized only the cognized. Thank you. And Bahiya became enlightened. And people say, there you go, you don't need jhanas. Bahiya, he just heard these teachings and became enlightened. So have you heard those teachings? You enlightened yet? In the seen will be just the seen, in the heard will just be the heard. In a sense, just a sense, in the cognized, just the cognized. Has that happened yet? That's number two times. Come on! The point is that when we have those teachings in the suttas, they just focus on a most important part of the whole process. You don't see the rest of the process which happened beforehand, but fortunately we know exactly what happened to Bahiya, because it's elsewhere in the suttas. There were seven monks in the time of Genakasapa, the Buddha, who decided to meditate to become enlightened or die. So they climbed off a mountain and they threw down the ladder. So no food, no return, they're going to become enlightened or die there. And I think one of them became enlightened, one of them became an anagami, I think the other ones became stream winners. Bahiya wasn't one of the ones who didn't become anything. But that's the type of, in his previous life, that's the type of resolve he had. And would you do that? Just say, I'm not going to leave this meditation retreat no matter what, even if I die. No more food, no more cups of tea, I'm just going to sit here no matter what. That was incredible resolve. And Bahiya got reborn in the time of the Buddha. He became a little sailor, won fortunes, lost fortunes, but at one time he got shipwrecked. And he managed to make it to the shore, but he lost all his clothes, he was completely naked. And so he got some bark, tree bark, to cover himself up. And when he went into the first village, they saw this guy, who was just actually a sailor, being shipwrecked, wearing bark, and they thought he was a holy man. You know what it's like in India? If you do anything weird or strange, they think you're a holy man. And they love holy men, and they feed them. And they feed them reasonably well, actually very well. And they also, you know, give them other gifts and give you got respect. And this guy here thought, wow, if I never found out this is an easy life, it's much better than going to sea. All you have to do is wear this bark and you get fed and you get respected. It's a great life. And the people were respecting him so much that they thought he was enlightened. Because then, you know, anyone that does any weird things or strange things, or especially if they're really tough and they don't sleep and they don't eat and they do all this weird stuff, they think that must be enlightened. Because people always like ascetics. So he thought he was enlightened himself. But then one of his mates from that mountain, who was an anagami, came down and said, look, Bahiya, you're not enlightened. You're not even on the path of being enlightened. You haven't got a clue. But he said, there is a guy who is enlightened, the Buddha. Go go and see him. And fortunately for Bahia, he made that trip from the west coast of India to the Ganges plain in one night. He had psychic powers. Now, you don't have those psychic powers without jhanas, not those type of psychic powers. Also, you don't able to listen to these devas without, you know, very good meditation. So this fellow had a natural meditation from his previous life. So when he actually listened to the Buddha, he'd already had the experiences of deep meditation. And I wrote about that in length in the Tricycle magazine, in Bahia's teaching, to make exactly the point to answer this question. When you look at spontaneous enlightenment in the suttas, it's the same when you go to a person's house and you see a picture of them getting their degree. There they are in a funny suit, and there's some dignitary over there, also dressed like a penguin, and handing them sort of a certificate. Is that all you need to get a degree? Just to wear a funny suit and go to the university at the right time? Someone says, you know, here's your name, here's a degree. Because that's what it looks like. That's the photograph you take. Because you want to take the photograph, the final act, the most important part of the whole process. And that's what people remember, just the final act. But in those final acts is also all of the hard work at university, going to the lectures, doing the assignments, taking the exams. But you don't take photographs of those. Just take the photograph of the last act. And that's like many of these teachings in our stories in the suttas. So fast at that last word, which just pushed you over the edge and made you an arahant or a stream winner. So that's why you still have to have those jhanas. Otherwise, the Buddha would have been inconsistent, self-contradictory, and deceiving people when he said you have to have those things. Furthermore, Devadatta presumably had attained high jhanas as evidenced by his psychic powers. He did. Yet did not appear to have attained stream entry. Correct. Jhanas are a prerequisite for becoming a stream winner or becoming an arahat, but just because you've got jhanas doesn't mean you will become a stream winner. At least you've got the causes in place. If you've got matches, you can start a fire. If you haven't got matches, you can't. If you've got an airline ticket, you can fly back to Sydney. If you haven't got an airline ticket, you can't. But just because you've got one, doesn't mean you're going to fly back. You might decide to, I'm not going to go back to Sydney, I'm going to stay here and meditate with Ajahn Brahm. I'm going to be a monk or a nun with Dharmasara from now on. But you have to have an airline ticket before you can fly. In the same way, you need the jhanas. But just because you've got a jhana doesn't mean you can become enlightened. But without one, you can't. And where Alara Kalaman, Uddaka Ramaputta, merely falls because the Buddha thought of them first when he asked to teach those with little dust in their eyes, which was implied that they were capable of significant meditative feats. They were capable of good feats, and they were very, very profound, but people say, did they have the jhanas? And this is actually one of those arguments, and I've convinced many people now that the only consistent resolution is that what Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta taught were not the immaterial attainments. They could not have been, because the immaterial attainments can only be got on the foundation of jhanas. And the Buddha said that those teachings, what those two teachers did, are not conducive to enlightenment. However, the immaterial attainments, later said by the Buddha, are conducive to enlightenment. They're necessary for it. They're one of the 11 gateways to enlightenment. So the only way there we can actually resolve that, and it makes a lot of sense, I've convinced many people, is what those two teachers taught were not the real thing. They weren't the real attainment of nothingness or the real attainment of neither perception or non-perception. They had the same names, but they were just mental constructs, not the real thing. In the same way that you can ride off to a university in the United States and get a degree these days without doing any work. You can get even a doctorate if you give enough money. So it's got the name, you've got the piece of paper, but it's not the real thing. It's just a remnant. The real thing actually has to be based on jhanas. And when the Buddha remembered his experience of jhana. He never remembered any experience of jhana under Alarakalama and Udakaramaputta. He went right back to the time under the rose apple tree as a small boy. And so there's a very, 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 very strong argument to say what Alarakalama and Udakaramaputta were teaching weren't the real thing, weren't real jhanas. And even these days, later on when I describe what jhanas are, that it's a very, very refined state. You can't hear, you can't feel the body, you can't think. And even today, there are many people who argue with me, who say, oh, that jhana Brahmi just puts the bar too high. And in our jhanas, yeah, you can still hear sound, you can still think, you've got some happiness and your pity still, and that's real jhana. They're lowering the bar. And because they lower the bar, it's very popular. So it's actually much easier to get a jhana under these teachers than get a jhana under Ajahn Brahm, but he's just too tough. And so because of that, you know, sort of some people, wishful thinking, they want the easy way, but I have to be sort of sincere and honest. Those aren't the real thing. When I was visiting teachers such as Joseph Goldstein and Jack Cornfield, they were talking what they call jhana light. They called it, with, you know, L-I-T-E, just like, you know, have all this like milk with, you know, with no cream in it. You know, like, you know, milk light. In other words, it's, you know, similar to the real thing, but it's not quite the real thing. And so they were calling jhana light when you can actually, you've got some lots of peace and lots of happiness, but you can still think and you can still hear sounds. And that's, you know, there's no such thing as like jhana light, it's not the real thing. It's on the way there, good on you, making some good samadhi, but it's not the real thing. But, you know, people go around thinking it's the real thing, because the teachers say so and because you get popular. Make sense? Okay, but carry on, there's lots of questions. What's the time? Let's be getting. Well, it's 9:30, shall we? Maybe one more question, and the rest of them we'll do tomorrow, because it's still realize it's so late. It's 9:30 already. Just one last question. Why is it, especially today, I've noticed it a lot, something chronic, although... Although it happens when not here, but I presume it is a normal aspect of the thinking, planning mind, that I plan and think of what I'll say or ask you as a question, and then imagine what you will say back. This seems to go back and forth, back and forth. I guess a habitual pattern that I use in most working out situations inside. It's annoying to be so caught up in this play I create, which seems so scaringly real, not really, but so lifelike. How do I get rid of this? Should I apply this is good enough technique? Yeah, well, what you're saying there is that sometimes if you come to an interview or you ask a question, you think, I'll ask this, and then he'll say that, and then, well, I'll say something else. And we just plan it all out, and you should know by now, it never works like that. I figured that out when I was a young man chatting up girls. Because you plan what you're going to say. You see a nice girl in the sort of the dance or the nightclub or whatever, and you say, plan what you're going to say. You figure it all out. This is what I'm going to say. Something really cool, something really sharp. And you go up there, and of course you get nervous, you forget what you're going to say, and you say something absolutely stupid and feel a right idiot. And if she was actually kind and she liked you, she wouldn't listen to that because she'd say something nice back. You know, because he didn't really care what she was saying. And so in the end, so you realize that all this planning is a complete waste of time. So in the end, I decided I'd just go and enjoy myself, just whatever comes in my mind, just relax. And I found out, and this, sometimes I teach this, because I went to Singapore once, and they said, you know, we've got a youth group. But the youth group, they're fed up with listening to Eightfold Path and Four Noble Truths. I've heard that so many times, it doesn't really relate to them. So, you know, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you sort of good talker, can you teach them something which is relates to their daily life? I said, okay, I'll teach them how to chat up girls. And how the girls can catch a guy. And so I spent half an hour talking to them about things which really concern them. And how to use Buddhism, sort of, you know, in the nightclub. Because why not? If Buddhism is going to be relevant to people, you've got to actually bring it down to people's levels. And little things like non-self, anatta. What does anatta mean in a nightclub? What anatta means in a nightclub is just forget about yourself, relax, don't care what other people think of you. And that's where I told that wonderful old joke story. When you're in your 20s, And most of these youth were in their 20s. You're just so concerned what other people think of you. And that's your problem. Like, and even this questioner there, I'll ask him this, but what will other people think of me if I ask that question? Will they think I'm dumb and stupid, asking such a silly question? That's why people just don't ask questions. They're afraid what other people think of them. And that's why when you're in your 20s, you have to learn, you know, the street cred lingo, you know, just the right words to say. You have to look sharp, you know, you have to keep the proper fashion, and it's just such an imposition on you, trying to keep up and say the right thing and like the right music or whatever, because it's changing so fast. But when you're in your 20s, you're really concerned what other people think of you. And you know, girls have to stand in the mirror a long time, and boys even longer. Why will they look like? And in your 40s, and many of you that old actually past that you know what it's like in your 40s, you don't give a damn what other people think of you. You get what's called self-confidence. And when you're in your 60s, so the saying goes, you finally find out that no one was thinking about you anyway. They're all thinking about themselves. And I tell you that, look, when you go up to a girl, you can say whatever you like, because she's not thinking of you, she's thinking what she's going to say. And she's concerned about herself. That's why, the same way you're concerned about yourself. So you don't have to worry at all. So just say whatever you want, be confident. And when you're confident, you really come across as, you know, as attractive. People like confident people. Just, you know, look at me, because I say all sorts of things about all sorts of stuff. I don't know what I'm supposed to be saying. I always get away with it. I gave this talk at UWA a few weeks ago on water resources. It was in the Department of Water Conservation and Resources. I don't know anything about water. So I got away. I gave a whole hour talk on water resources. And they thought it was very good. And I remember at this transport conference I did, it was in Duxton Hotel, just in Perth here. Because, you know, we were fighting these clay trucks for quite a few years, and so there was a transport conference. You know, the Minister of Planning, Lana McTiernan, invited me over there. And during the conference, somebody saw me. I was wearing my robes, I always have to. And so they interviewed me for this transport journal. So what do you think about, like, you know, shipping? And so I said all this stuff about shipping. And, you know, I've been in a ship in my life. I don't know anything about transport or shipping, but I've spouted all this stuff. And it was amazing. This guy came to me about 12 months later, and he said, now, I wrote this article after this interview, and I called it Zen and the Art of Shipping. And he said, you wouldn't believe how popular that article was. It was syndicated in all the shipping magazines in the world. And he got all this feedback, you know, from all these experts saying, I don't know who that Ajahn Brahm is, but he really knows what he's talking about. So much good fun, that. You haven't got a clue what I'm talking about, shipping. But you say these things, and the other time was when I went on to 6PR radio a few years ago. And that was a good fun, because it was late at night, because sometimes I, you know, like to do these things. And it was usually, I don't mind giving talks, but sometimes I can't fit it into the schedule. But this was late at night, about 10 to 12, and I think it was a Friday night or Saturday or something. After the talks, I was free, so I went to the station and said, yeah, I can do that. So I went into the station, went into the studio, and I had the headphones on, and then, you know, I asked him, actually, what's this show all about anyway? And I should have asked first of all, because the show, if it's late at night, you know, you can expect this, it was on adult themes about, you know, your sexual performance and, you know, your intimate details of, you know, your lovemaking. It was on sex. And I was sitting next to this lady called Dr. Gabriel Morrissey, who is actually as a sexologist. She's one of the best experts in the whole of the country. And there was on a talkback radio station, you know, the monk and his sex expert fielding calls. And I've been celibate for 33 years, I think now. But I got away with it again. It's good fun. But a lot of it's just confidence. You know, you should make it up as you go along. And you Oh, great fun of a monk. When you don't care what people think of you, you know, then you can do these things. And you have great fun and confident, and people like it. And, you know, all the calls are actually coming to me at the end. And this, I was sitting next to this doctor, she was supposed to be the expert about all these books. And she was just bored out of her skull because no one wanted to talk to her. They're getting all this advice from the monk. That's absolutely right. I had good fun as a monk. So yeah, no, so to make it relevant, sort of, you know, you can actually do all these, well, I don't know what the question was anyway. Okay. Oh yes, right, about planning what you're going to say and not going to say. So it's great that, you know, you all know, because you see me at work so often, you don't plan what you're going to say. And that's why I'm a popular public speaker. So you don't have to be concerned or worried, just be confident, whatever you say is okay. And so that way you don't have to worry about planning everything beforehand so many times and getting your sort of your head just really stuffed up with all these plans and thoughts. It never works out as expected to be anyway, so just shut up and just do it and just enjoy. Okay, so there's lots of questions for tomorrow. Perhaps we'll sort them out tomorrow. Who knows, tomorrow might not come. You might be all delight tomorrow and you don't need any questions anymore. Tonight might be your night. If it's not, then go to bed. So, see you tomorrow morning. Have a nice night.